I'm Jen. Thank you for having me. Pardon? Yeah, I think so. That's okay. Is that okay? Can everyone hear me? Yes, thank you for having me. Please bear with me. I'm not great at public speaking, but I'm happy to be here and have a conversation with you, which is, I understand how it works here. So, yes, the title of my talk was meant to be Women, Sex and Death in the Davidic Narrative. And so I'm just wondering, have you ever noticed that when a woman enters the story in David, someone dies? So you're probably thinking, you're trying to rack your brains thinking of women in the David story, and I bet you're thinking of Bathsheba. So the Uriah dies and the infant son. You might then think of Abigail and her husband, the fool Nabal, he dies. You might think of Michal, another wife of David's. And what was the bride price for Michal? 100 Philistine foreskins. I think they all died. And then there's some lesser known ones. There's some concubines that you may not have heard of. There's Rizpah, better known for guarding the bodies of her adult sons when David has them killed in revenge. But earlier on in the story, she's still a concubine of Saul's, and there's an argument between Ishbosheth and Abner about her, about whether one of them had slept with her. They later die. And at the very end of David's life, there's a search of all Israel to find a beautiful young woman for him. That's obviously David's thing. And they find Abishag. And again, same thing happens as with Rizpah. Someone says, I want to sleep with her. And that's considered to be pretty much declaring a coup if you sleep with the king's concubines. So Solomon has him killed. That was Ahithophel. And for good measure, they killed Joab as well. So that's a lot of deaths, isn't it, that comes about, that can be traced back through a woman entering the story. But you might also think that there's actually a lot of death in the David story in general. So how would we know which is about women and which isn't? And that's fair enough. That nobody in the Bible receives as many reports of death as David does. And he orders a lot of them himself. But I still think there is something in that. I think there is some connection there, some symbolic associations that are tied up with women, sex and death. And the sex part comes from the fact that the women that I've just mentioned all have a role in the story where their identity is caught up in their sexual identity. Their function in the story is their sexual identity. There's a few other women that we know of where that doesn't actually happen. So there's something going on here. And I've chosen today to talk about one woman in the story I didn't mention, who is the one I want to focus on today, and that's the rape of Tamar. So that was a really good introduction, and I'm really impressed by you girls. That's, yeah, really great. So the rape of Tamar. Yeah, has anyone ever heard a sermon on the rape of Tamar, just out of interest? No, neither. Oh, there's one. Okay. And neither have I. And I think that's understandable. I'm not surprised at that. And it's like the lady was saying, it's because it will raise things for people, because there's inevitably someone will be affected by it. Okay, so the rape of Tamar, this story comes in chapter 13 of the book of 2 Samuel, and it comes just after the affair with Bathsheba, David's affair with Bathsheba, where her husband is killed in the battle. Is everyone mostly familiar with that story? Yep, and then after that, the prophet Nathan comes up to David and tells him, as an oracle from God, that the sword will never depart from his house. So then David, and then the infant son dies. That's kind of the first bad thing that happens to David. And then he goes back to war. And we end up, it says some time passed, and we end up at this story. So, and actually, it just occurred to me, this week is White Ribbon Day on Tuesday, which is about violence against women. So it's actually, in the end, call it God's timing, coincidence, or whatever, quite appropriate to be looking at this story. That worked out well. Excuse me for a moment. Okay, so some time has passed, and we find out that Absalom has a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And then the firstborn son of David, whose name was Amnon, is in love with her. But it's not really love, actually. A better translation would be lust. And he is so in lust with Tamar that he makes himself physically sick. And so he catches the attention of people because he's just looking so awful. And in particular, he catches the attention of someone who's both a friend and also a brother of David, so his uncle, called Jonadab, who asks what's going on. And he tells him. And so Jonadab, who's apparently very crafty, comes up with a plan. And the plan is for Amnon to pretend to be sick and lie up in bed, and then Jonadab's going to direct David's attention to this and ask David to tell Tamar to come and make some food for him. So the reason Amnon is so sick and is because he can't... It says he's in love or in lust with Tamar, but he can't do anything to her. And you might be thinking the reason he can't do anything to her is because they're related, you know, they're half-siblings. But it's actually not so much that as the fact that Tamar is a virgin, because you were not allowed to have sex with a virgin. And also it meant that she was physically located in a different part of the palace. You imagine a massive palace and they're all in separate compounds within it. She would have been a long way from him. He simply didn't have access to her. So they have to come up with this scheme to somehow draw Tamar into to Amnon's circle. So he does this, and he lies in bed, and David notices, and Amnon explains what's going on. So he says, "Come, make my sister Tamar come and give me something to eat, and prepare the food in my sight, so that I may see it and eat it from her hand." So David does this. He sends to Tamar, says, "Go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him." Tamar obviously is not in a position to disobey, is she? She goes to her brother Amnon's house where he was lying down. And this is really interesting. It says she took dough, kneaded it, made cakes in his sight, and baked the cakes. So I'll come back to that later. But I just want to say there's a bit of a play on words happening here about this making of the food. We lose a bit in the translation. In the Hebrew, the word for cakes and the word for baking are a pun on the word for heart. So he's actually saying, let's make some heart cakes. I think there's actually an erotic pun intended. It'd be more accurate to say, let's make some libido cakes or something like that. So when he says that to David, come and make me these heart cakes, make me these libido cakes, David probably has some inkling of what's going on. It's not an innocent request. So she took the dough, she kneaded it, she made cakes in his sight and baked the cakes. It's very voyeuristic, isn't it? I think we're invited into Amnon's gaze as he watches her. And he's probably also getting himself aroused as well. So she takes a pan and sets it out before him that he refuses to eat, because obviously it's a ruse. So we get to, she's done, fulfilled what she was asked to do, and Amnon says, get rid of her, everyone leave the room. And then he says to Tamar, bring the food into the chamber so that I can eat from your hand. So Tamar took the cakes she had made and brought them to the chamber to Amnon, her brother. So you can imagine what's going on for Tamar here. This is probably, she's probably thinking something's up by now, like this is not the usual behaviour. She goes into his bedroom, and she hands him the cakes. It says, but when she brought them near to him to eat, he took hold of her and said, come lie with me, my sister. And so now the game is up. And I can only imagine the fear she's feeling. Bearing in mind, this Tamar is probably the age of the young people who did our service today. She's very young. She has no idea. And she still has the presence of mind to say, no. So she says, no. No, my brother, do not force me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do anything so vile. As for me, where would I carry my shame? And as for you, you would be as one of the scoundrels in Israel. Now, therefore, I beg you, speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. So I think that's pretty amazing, that she's got the presence of mind to defend herself verbally. And she's very eloquent. And she's in an honour and shame society. She goes back to the fact that she will be dishonoured. She will not. She will be totally covered in shame and unable to live. And he also, he'll be the scoundrel. He's also going to be pretty, you know, he's not going to be very well regarded if he does this. They refer to, you know, it's not done in Israel. We all know that this is not how we live here. These are not how we carry ourselves. And actually she says, she even comes up with a solution. She says, speak to my father and he'll arrange it. Now, to us, that seems pretty awful, like as if you'd want to marry someone who had just done that to you. But for her, the alternative is so dire that she's willing to do that. And it is technically possible. It could have been done. But, of course, that's not really what this is about. Amnon doesn't actually want Tamar for herself. He just wants to take away her virginity. says Amnon would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, he forced her and lay with her. And I take from that that she actually put up a bit of a fight, that she did put up some physical resistance as well, because it says, you know, he was stronger and had to force her. So it's very sad, because she's raped. And then there's an interesting turning point here. It says, Amnon was seized with a very great loathing for her. Indeed, his loathing was even greater than the lust he had felt for her. So there's a real about change here. And again, we lose a little bit in the translation, because in the actual Hebrew, when you want to make a point about something, you repeat the word over and over. So this bit here would actually go, Amnon hated Tamar with a very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. So this is where I'm happy to throw open here. What's going on for Amnon here? What's happened? Yep. And so when he reaches that, when he's had, you know, he's reached the climax of what he wanted, which, as you say, was not really about the act, what happens then? What happens to himself internally? Yeah, basically, yeah, I think so. I think it's a really profound insight from the narrator that, yeah, he's filled with his own disgust and shame. And those are emotions that, as humans, we actually find really difficult to deal with. And, yeah, he bundles it all up and projects it back onto Mar.
He probably despises her as well, because there seems to be strange belief among men to do that kind of thing. Somehow or other, a woman really hadn't wanted it. She just somehow or other managed to get away.
Yeah.
So even the fact that she put herself in this situation where she went from her in the first place, he probably then said, well, if she hadn't known what was coming, she would have done that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's easy to find ways to blame her rather than accept responsibility. Yeah.
When that sort of thing happens.
That you would have the self-loathing?
That passion, that wanting, turns into equally violent rejection.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess in the context of the story, when we hear at the start, oh, he's just so, you know, in love with her, which he obviously wasn't. Now suddenly he hates her. It's such an abrupt shift. And I think, as I said before, it's quite a profound thing to say about us as humans. And unfortunately, it doesn't get any better for Tamar. He says to her, get out. And again, I just love Tamar. She goes, no. She says, no again. My brother, this is wrong. This wrong is greater than the other that you did to me. Because in Israelite society, what happens if you're a young woman and you're not married and you don't have children? You know, you don't really have a life at all. And she knows that if she's no longer a virgin, she won't be able to marry. And so essentially she's looking at her life is over. So the only alternative for her is for... And what was the penalty for somebody who raped? It was to marry the victim, which we can't understand now, but it's because of that reason, because if a woman was left no longer a virgin, they were unmarriageable, so the penalty had to be that you married them. So she knows, yeah, that's why she's saying it's a greater wrong than what you've already done. But he would not listen to her. He called the young man who served him and said, put this woman out of my presence and bolt the door after her. So now he's changed his language a lot. It's actually not so much this woman as this thing. He's actually just being really dismissive and nasty now. And that's exactly what happened. She's cast out of the room. Now, Tamar, as a virgin, was wearing a long robe. So a long robe with sleeves. This is how the virgin daughters of the kings were clothed in earlier times. So after she's put out, yet again, she's determined to not take this without letting people know what's going on. It says, Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long robe she was wearing. She put her hand on her head and went away crying aloud as she went. So by tearing the robe symbolically, the robe is the same word used for Joseph's robe, so a very distinctive and beautiful garment. By tearing it, she's showing that symbolically, you know, her status has changed. And the ashes on the head, obviously, in the Old Testament, a very traditional way of mourning. So everybody knows. And again, I just admire Tamar so much that She really didn't have much control over her own life, but what little she had, she used it to the full. She pleaded a case, and then she acted symbolically when she could. So now she returns to her own home within the harem. And her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon your brother been with you?" And that's an interesting point, because I think it shows that Absalom must have been aware that Amnon was a bit funny. He just seems to have guessed it. So it makes me a little suspicious of Absalom as well. "Be quiet now, my sister, he is your brother. Do not take this to heart." So again, Tamar is silenced by another man. And so she spends the rest of her life, it says she remains desolate within the house of Absalom. Absalom was actually the person who was there to look after her. So she would have returned to her mother and Absalom's house. She was unable to marry, as I said before, unable to have children, basically unable to fulfill her function as a woman in that society. So, what about David's response to all of this? "When King David heard of all these things, he became very angry, but he would not punish his son Amnon because he loved him, for he was his firstborn." So, the penalty for somebody who had committed rape but didn't marry the victim was death. So that's what David was supposed to have done. And it says, although it says that he didn't do it because he loved his son Amnon because he was his firstborn, we already know that David's just done the same thing with Bathsheba. So part of why he's not doing it is because he knows the same thing should have happened to him. So here we have a fairly desolate story. And the deaths in this story, when I mentioned before that, when a woman enters the story, people die. Well, the people who die in this story are Amnon and Absalom. So Amnon is killed by Absalom. He orders it through a dinner party that David somehow doesn't get invited to. And then later on, we know that Absalom also is killed in a failed coup against David. And those deaths are sort of linked back to this story. So where is God in this story? Or more to the point, where is God not? Because God doesn't actually appear, there's no mention of God here. And it's been called the painful truth of Yahweh through the David story, that when incidents like this happen, it just seems like either God is nowhere to be seen or that God has even somehow condoned what's happened. Because the latest we hear of God is in the oracle from Nathan that, David's dynasty is about to decline and the sword will come on his house. It almost makes it sound as though the rape of Tamar is about David's suffering. And so you can take that in a few ways. There's a Jewish saying that says you can oppose God as long as it's in defence of God's creation. So if you take the text at its face value, then that might be of some comfort. You can have that out with God. I choose not to do that, however. I think God is definitely present here. And I think God is suffers with Tamar. So the reason I think that, though, is because this story is here at all. So it's pretty amazing that a story that is utterly negative about all of the men and seemingly about God has actually left, is still with us. It's still part of the traditions and stories that are told. And there's a feminist theology saying that says the Bible makes provision for its own critique. So even though everything that happens in this story is despicable and there's no excuses, it's amazing that it's actually still here, that we are able to say that, we're able to judge the men involved and what went on. And that I attribute that to God, because I believe God does care about Tamar. I think this story is here because it's about Tamar. It's not about David. And the lovely thing about it is that later on we find out, it's in the next verse, chapter 14, that Absalom had a daughter called Tamar. But the verse actually reads, "There were born to Absalom three sons and one daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman." But the interesting thing is that we never hear the names of daughters. Tamar is the only daughter of David's we know of, and we don't know of any other daughters that were born to him. We know that there were some, we just never know their names. And so likewise with Absalom, it's interesting that the three sons are not named, but Tamar is. And I think it's a way of allowing Tamar's memory to live on. So I take hope that God does, he cares and he suffers along with her. So if that's, and like I was saying, if the Bible does make provision for its own critique, why is this story here? Like I said, I refuse to accept that this story is here to tell us anything about David. This story is about Tamar in and of itself. And I think it's very vivid. I think the detail in it is really vivid. And it says something quite profound about the human condition. But what I want to draw out of it, and what I take a little bit of issue with that story there, is that it's not just about one rotten egg who did a bad thing, because it's actually about systemic abuse of power. Because in the end, it took... Who did it take for this to happen? It wasn't just Amnon. It was also Jonadab and David. They all conspired against Tamar to make it happen. And Tamar's very eloquent speech draws that out. And even Absalom, although I do think he cared for Tamar, I do think he did, he also stood a lot to gain from this because he knew that the penalty for what happened was death. That was going to leave him as next in line to the throne. And I think there is probably a bit of self-interest in Absalom as well. And sadly, right now, people are giving testimony at the Royal Commission. Into institutional responses to child sex abuse of children who have been abused by church leaders. But the church does what David did. Ah, it's all too hard. I'm not going to deal with it. These people are special to us. It's all too hard. They don't respond at all. It shows that it's actually a systemic issue. It's not about, and I think that somehow, sometimes the churches have tried to say, oh, that was just a few bad eggs. But it's not that, because they could have done something. The cynical writer of Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun. So just what happened to Tamar happens today. The difference is, and what we need to take some comfort from, is that today a woman doesn't have to be defined by what happens to her body. It's not as though she can't marry or move on in her relationships or her life. Although, in actual fact, in some cultures that is the case. So, returning to my theme of women, sex and death in the David story. Well, my personal view is that it's a symbolic association that projects an unconscious fear of women. That's what I think it's about. If you think about many of the Proverbs, there are a lot of warnings about foreign women who are going to seduce you. You know, we mask, the writers of the Bible sometimes used women in their sexual nature to blame them for men not being able to control themselves. But what I take from it, though, I don't allow it to stay there. I think what is interesting is that even though each of the women that I mentioned at the start, and certainly with Tamar, they don't have much control over their own lives, they don't have much ability to act, they usually don't have much ability to speak. But the fact that they cause or lead to all these deaths of other people, it actually gives them a very powerful presence in the text, which is very meaningful. And that's what I take from that text. That's what I take from that association. We had the artwork. Oh, good. This is an interesting artwork. I found it quite confronting when I saw it, mostly because of the dagger. And I thought, that's not in the story. But in actual fact, it could well have been, just because it didn't say that. He obviously overpowered her some way. It could well have been. I'm not saying it didn't. But what else do you notice about this picture that's of interest? Yeah, the person running away. Because in the story, it says that... everybody was ordered out of the room so that Amnon could take Tamar back to his bedchamber. So this painting is suggesting that someone disobeyed that order and they end up being a witness to it. And we are like that witness. We're a witness to what happened because we're here, we have this text, we have this story. So we're a witness. And that's what that lady was saying, is that we need to take that and be a part of the solution. Could have been. But I think because he's already started on it. Yeah, I think he's hung around a bit longer. Yeah. Can I encourage you, if this is a live issue for you, to seek someone to talk to after the service, and Ken would probably be able to help you if that's something that you need. But that's my feeling about Tamar. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to say about Tamar?
You know, it's just thinking, coming into Christmas, that Jesus often was given the appellation of Son of David, and he didn't reject that. And I like, in a way, the fact that his lineage, that they constructed such a great story to make sure that we could make the story come true that he was the son of David. But he accepts the lineage of all that stuff.
That's
that
right.
Stuff. He doesn't separate himself from the messiness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, yeah. And the interesting thing about the story, because Amnon and Absalom were the ones who were meant to have taken over from David, but of course Solomon takes over. And I love the fact that with whatever happened to Bathsheba, I mean, that's a whole other story, isn't it? But that she managed to make it so that Solomon was on the throne. And that actually changes the course of history. So I love that a woman who may or may not have been able to act in her own life, have any agency or any control over her life, actually changes the course of history, quite literally. And then also in that lineage is Rahab and other people with suspect backgrounds. Sorry, what was it?
And shows me that he had sort of disempowered himself by his own behaviour, and then I can see that going right through his whole relationship with his sons is changing and weak, and although he's a king and he does things as a king that are really admirable, as a father he's pretty awful.
Yeah, he's woeful, yeah. Amnon's a bit of a chip off the old block, you could say. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't know what else he had to go on to be any better. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm disturbed by the, I think, quite appropriate parallel made between the systemic cultural view of women in power and the way in which nothing's changed.
Mm. Yeah.
It doesn't actually seem to make any difference.
Yeah.
In fact, it seems to facilitate power because you have power structures created which facilitate that abuse.
Yeah. And you could even say, I mean, the Royal Commission was resisted for a long time by government because of their connection with the Catholic Church. So it's even like bringing in that third tier in like what happens with the Tamar story. It's systemic, it is. And I think the purpose of this story, in a way, is for us to grieve with Tamar. Like, there's nothing really left to do. There is no good that can come out of this for her. And because I refuse to accept that it's about David, I think we're just left to lament. And there's a place for that, that's all there is. Yeah.
A classic example of writing women out of the story is our sisters of Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we know there were many women who attended Jesus, don't we? Yeah. And why do you think that happens? Yeah, it's a very obviously it's a patriarchal society that happens. Yeah, we haven't moved on. I think that's what you're saying, isn't it, Paul? We haven't moved on as far as we might like to think, unfortunately. But also, in some cultures today, if a woman is raped, their life is still effectively over. They're still, you know, and I think we, in some ways, have moved on a lot. But
there's countries today where a woman is raped,
she's punished. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It happened in Ireland as well. It's a reveal just recently.
Yeah.
A young girl was raped by the priest. She went and told the sisters, and she was the one that was guilty.
Yeah. Yeah. This is true. Thank you for pointing that out. and that's what, and I think she's making that point, isn't she? The lady in that clip was saying this is somebody who doesn't have a vested interest in this and is someone who's quite privileged by not having to be a part of the conversation, but who is choosing to. And from what I can gather about the White Ribbon campaign, I don't know if people know more about it than me, but that's what that's aimed at, is men making a pledge that they will take a stand against violence against women. And I think the men who are likely to do that are probably not the men for whom it is directed at, but it is important that all men do that. Yeah, and there's some lovely gentlemen, you're right. Definitely.
My uncle, one of my oldest cousins is actually the product of a raid by a Russian soldier at the end of the Second World War. She was Austrian, and when Austria was liberated, Austria was considered a Nazi country. And when the Russians came in, the rape of women happened everywhere. My uncle had met her in a concentration camp, and even though she was already pregnant from that rape, they got married and went on to have a really great life together. And it's interesting to me that whole power thing, what automatically came to mind actually was the 300 girls who were abducted.
I know, yeah, good point. Yep.
To become wives to men they've never met before. And that surely must be a power thing more than anything, because those girls were Christian girls and are now Muslim and supposedly married to Muslim men. And it's not a religion thing, it's a power thing.
Yeah, always.
And it continues to be that. I think one of the reasons it's hard to have the conversation casually is because women who know men who aren't like that don't like to raise a conversation that would imply they think men are all like that. And it sort of immediately does that as soon as you raise the issue. It's like, oh, you think all men are like men.
Yeah.
And that's so
demeaning. Yes.
For a lot of men.
Yeah.
But if we don't have a conversation, it doesn't even give a chance to articulate.
Yeah,
that.
That's a very good point.
I don't know how you begin conversations without.
I think I wonder if that's what this campaign is aimed at, though. Is that very thing that men themselves actually need to say? We need to have this conversation. Yeah. We need to be a part of this solution. And again, it shouldn't have to be women who drive it. In that women are not the problem. Women are never the problem. What happened to Tamar was nothing to do with Tamar. So,
And I think we've also, in the church, we've swallowed a theology that precludes rage. It says we have to forgive everything. Forgive. Let it go. It doesn't matter. Sweep it under the carpet. You're not allowed to be angry about it.
Definitely. And I do like that Jewish idea that oppose God. If it's about God's creation and suffering, then oppose God. We can do that. God is strong enough, and we need to have that out. Yep, absolutely.
Part of the problem there is, well, in the broadest term, denominationalism, but if you're part of a particular organisation and you do this, and it's very clear that this is a Christian organisation, the first reaction of the people who run the organisation is going to be, this would really damage the reputation of the organisation.
Yep.
Not worried about the reputation of Jesus, let's worry about the reputation of the organisation.
And
when it comes out, it's much, much worse than it would have been if they just...
Exactly. And that's what this Royal Commission is just showing time and time again. It's extremely sad. Yeah. Particularly the Catholic Church, Salvation Army has taken a hammering. A lot of churches, have been shown to do that because, as you say, more about the bottom line, their dollars, their reputation, than about either the victims or, as you say, teachings of love and Jesus.
I think it's really important to have conversations and allow people to have a space to reveal abuse, because a friend of ours has had a child raped 3 years ago, just was revealed about a month ago.
So awful,
I think it's worth noting that just because some men don't, well, a lot of men don't rape, that doesn't change the fact that some do.
Mm.
And if you tell someone like who has been sexually abused, oh, not all men rape, that doesn't change the fact that they were sexually abused by a man. Like,
yeah, that's right.
That.
No, it doesn't. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, the way structures of domination work, it just happens to be that we're still in a very patriarchal situation.
Can I just say one thing about, I'm not sure whether I misheard you or misinterpreted what you said. I am a victim of sexual assault, and it happened with a female boss I was working in. The power thing was awful, and I had read so often that being in situations like that feel helpless, and I thought, why do they feel helpless? I felt totally helpless.
Absolutely. I would agree. I mean, Tamara is utterly helpless. There's nothing she can do, which I think is why it's quite amazing that, I mean, we don't know that this is exactly what happened. Obviously, the narrator wasn't there in the room, but the fact that he has her say those things is remarkable, because she is in a situation of utter powerlessness and helplessness. But I think she acts out of sheer desperation, and that's why I think... we just have to admire her. Her strength of character, with what little she had, she used. We need to admire her as a strong woman and honour that memory, I guess. And I'm very sorry as well.
And to say that being a strong woman didn't stop it happening to her.
Exactly, that's right.
It's not like, oh, it happened to you because you were a weak woman.
Yeah.
That she was the strongest possible woman in her culture she could be, and it still happened to
her. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I take great hope from conversations like this. I take great hope from the White Ribbon campaign.
Mm.
I take great hope from broader issues in this, that the shit is coming out into the light, you know, that it can be exposed and blamed and hopefully disempowered because of that, and saying this is not acceptable. So I take hope and for our women, for our daughters and our young men who are also abused. This is not just a thing of crime against women.
No. And that's probably a lovely note to end on, so thank you for that.